Welcome to the Kindlings Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Starr.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Dick Staub. You're listening to Kindlings Muse. I'm the guest tonight, and my friend Bill Hogg is out working the crowd, and he's going to get to some questions from our audience, and let's get started, Bill.
Okay, Jedediah gets the ball rolling this evening. If you would like to articulate your question for our crowd and the podcast posse. Okay.
It has been alleged that Christianity can only be fully radical when there is persecution and literal martyrdom. What is your opinion of this argument?
Well, in the book, I tell the contrasting story of a meeting I had with a house church pastor in China who'd spent 18 years in prison for his confession of Christ. And the beatings and the torture that he experienced, and he was quite honest with us that he, in his 18 years in prison, many times wanted to betray the faith, but could not get away from Philippians 2, where Jesus made himself no reputation, and he had this strong sense of suffering as being identifying with Christ. And I got back from that trip, and on the top of my mail stack, I was living in Chicago at the time, was a postcard, and it was from a seeker-friendly church, and it had a picture of a person in ball and chain. And it said, "Does going to church feel like going to jail?" And you flipped it over, and it said, "Not at our church." No, it didn't even say church. It said, "You know, we offer stadium-style seating, popcorn, face painting for the kids," and it had balloons on it. And it said, "And we'll never preach to you. All we will do is tell you stories about how you can be more successful." And I looked at that card and I asked myself, is this a different Christianity, or is it Christianity being adapted to a different culture? And that's a really serious question. And I do believe that that wealth and material prosperity is a difficult challenge to the faith, but I don't believe that a materially prosperous country is incapable of allowing God to be central. So I don't really buy the argument, but I understand when both Solzhenitsyn and Mother Teresa came to the United States, they both said, "This is the hardest country in the world to be a Christian." Mother Teresa said, "I pity you for your poverty, your spiritual poverty." In the Proverbs, there's this verse that said, "God, please do not make me wealthy, lest I forget you. Please do not make me poor, lest I steal." Okay, so whether you're poor or rich, all of us have the same central issue, which is, do we believe God should be central in our life and our purpose is to glorify God? So I think it has its own set of difficulties in our country, and Jesus said it's difficult for the rich to go, you know, like a camel going through the needle's eye, but it's not impossible. But he did tell the rich young ruler to sell everything he had and give it to the poor.
Well, from rich man, poor man, and the eye of a needle, we have a question from a patron of Live at Hales, the Kindlings, who'd like to remain anonymous, and said, "Some would argue that without commercialism, we would not spread the gospel. Without a TBN, and I almost gagged there, without a TBN or a Crystal Cathedral, how can we reach the masses otherwise?"
Well, you know, Jesus actually did go to a... I remember when I met Bill Mounts, who at the time was president of Whitworth College, but he was a New Testament scholar, and we were talking about this very issue. And he says, you know, Jesus really was very provincial. He lived in a small patch of land, small little country, didn't go outside of that country. He wasn't really cosmopolitan in a sense. His plan was relational. David McFadyen, who endorses this book, The Culturally Savvy Christian, is the creator of the TV show Home Improvement. And this podcast here tonight is partly because of a conversation I had with David. Because I used to do a nationally syndicated talk show. We had 350,000 average quarter-hour listeners on that show. And I maybe met 200 of them in my entire time that I did that show. And David said, you know, media is great for kind of making people think differently and it can get people's attention. But he said, bottom line, transformation happens local and in community. Jesus does not need the electronic airwaves. As a matter of fact, disembodied Christians is the last thing we need today. What we need is incarnation. We need people who actually live it. I mean, having been in the media, I was skeptical of media when I was in it, and I'm skeptical now that I'm at it, out of it. It's about relationships. It's about flesh and blood, you know. Media can do some good things, but it's very limited in what it can do.
All right, thanks, Dave.
Including this podcast.
Got a question from Phil.
Dick, if C.S. Lewis was alive today, what could possibly be the analogy to his BBC series of talks that would endure for 60, 70, 80 years today?
Well, that's a good question, because what Phil is pointing out is that during World War II, they were still in the Philco age, where people did gather around the radio. And Lewis actually did not seek out that opportunity. He was invited to come give a series of talks. So Lewis was not really about what can I do that's influential. He was about what can I do that I can do well. And he felt he was a writer and a scholar. So I don't think we should be aping all over ourselves looking for, you know, the most relevant medium. But I do think people that are talented in the medium should exercise their talents there. I've been asked, would Lewis have been a film screenwriter today? Would Lewis have been in the game world today because they reached 20-somethings? I mean, I think if Lewis felt what he did could be useful there, he might have considered it because he did have this sense of stewardship. But I also think that there's something amazing happening with something like podcasting. Podcasting is really narrowcasting, but people that want thoughtful conversations can find them in the podcast world today. And you can't find them in radio, generally. I mean, most of broadcasting today is hostile talk, political talk, frivolous talk, except NPR, which out of 100% of people listening to radio in any given market has about a 1.8% share. In other words, 98% of people are not listening to NPR. So if you want to have thoughtful, the reason we're doing podcasting is we can have these kind of conversations here and at the Kindling's Muse at C.S. Lewis. And it's limitless in terms of who it can reach, so long as people hear about it. And so I think new technologies are offering new opportunities to get the word out. I think C.S. Lewis might have written his same stuff, but done audio books of him reading them. He might have done a podcast of Screwtape. I mean, who knows what he might have done. But whatever he did, it would have been within the context of his own gifts and abilities, instead of being driven by some kind of missional desire.
And what we do know for certainty, Dick, is that the Inklings would not have taken place in cyberspace. It would need to happen in a pub. So we just thought we'd do it.
Yeah, for people that want to listen to our podcast, we did a show called Inklings 2.0, in which young'uns tried to argue that you could do that what Lewis and Tolkien and Charles Williams and Dorothy Sayers and others did in a pub in person could be done online. And I, being the old person, argued that I didn't think that was the case.
All right. Got a question from Chris.
Hi, Dick. Talk a little bit about how someone in a classic corporate career can be a countercultural Christian. Seems a little, it seems like a thoughtful creative has more to work with. What about the person that the apostle told to live a quiet life and work with your hands?
Yeah. Chris is making reference to a phrase that I like to use, which is, I think we want to raise up in the Christian community thoughtful creatives for whom God is of central importance. Now, what Chris is doing is applying it very specifically to artists and writers and filmmakers, because we do a series of by-invitation retreats for people like that. But I think you can be a thoughtful creative for whom God is of central importance wherever you are. If you're a homemaker, if you're an attorney, if you're a marketing person, if you're a thoughtful creative, that means that you're thinking about what you're doing and you're creative, you're bringing your own originality to your work and your personality and who you are, and you believe God is of central importance and you work that out in your day in, day out life. So I don't think we want to elevate the arts and artists and writers over anybody else, but neither do we want to place them off on some sidecar somewhere. I mean, the whole point is each of us have been given unique gifts and abilities and talents and opportunities. And if all of us took seriously being a thoughtful, creative pursuer of God in whatever we do, that's what Jesus meant by salt and light and kind of being, making the culture. Making the culture involves industry, it involves agriculture, it involves the arts, it involves every aspect of life. Attorneys, yes, maybe. No, absolutely. I mean, look at when you think about Wilberforce and how slavery actually ultimately was overcome. For those of you that saw Amazing Grace and those of you who know the story, it wasn't because Wilberforce was successful in creating holy, righteous indignation. It was because an attorney came with him with a peculiar little phrase in the law about flying flags that they managed to get passed in the House of Commons, and overnight slavery among the British commercial interest went away. It was an attorney. You know, so I absolutely mean every occupation can be used to the glory of God. But you have to be willing to put aside the normal drivers, which are fortune, fame, you know, the kinds of things, unfortunately, that most of us are entrapped in.
All right, now we go deep down under for the next question, Dick.
How does one peel back the onion, which is Christianity, and separate the dark ale from the light?
Well, when I look at, isn't it kind of basic, the Christian faith? I mean, you know, if you just read Jesus and you think about the Apostle Paul picking up on Jesus' theme of love, and Paul says, though I have knowledge and speak in tongues of angels and I give away everything I have, if I have not love, I am nothing at all. I mean, there's such a certain core things about Jesus' teaching that are so elementary. You know, Jesus, we're told, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld God's glory. And how did we behold it? He was full of grace and truth. This kind of authentic commitment to truth delivered with grace. These are the core elements of Christian faith. I mean, I have this like giant library that I keep winnowing down and trying to get rid of books, and I'm doing it right now. And I used to have like 6,000 volumes, and it's really stupid because Jesus, his own message was very, very basic. You know, and now all of us theologians and philosophers, and we're all writing all these books, except, of course, mine, which will be selling after the show tonight. But all the rest of those books. I mean, it's really kind of silly, isn't it? If we each did what we know instead of worrying about what we don't know. I mean, this is getting to the core of the gospel. And there's, you know, I like the Augustinian formula that in all things, in essentials, unity, in non-essentials, diversity, in all things, charity. And I think the essentials are really very few. You know, you can take most of what we're talking about in today's Christianity and put it in non-essential, and it'd be fine with Jesus. Yeah, it's fine with me.
It's fine with you. Got a question from Sandra for you, Dick.
You mentioned earlier that Christianity seems to be almost in danger of extinction here in the U.S., or it's close to, could be one generation away. Yet we see in other less affluent cultures around the world that it's exploding. And here at home we see also that it's becoming increasingly popular to support humanitarian causes. So do you see an opportunity to connect those two and to support the appeal of the Christian faith by getting back to the roots of Jesus' call to serve the poor and the oppressed?
Thank you. I think that unfortunately a lot of American charity is built by out of paternalism. I think there's a patronizing kind of, I know this for experience. As a matter of fact, one of my dear friends here in Seattle just made a trip to Rwanda, and he said that one of the Rwandan pastors mentioned to him that it had been noticeable to him that my friend had been asking a lot of questions and listening. And he said, most Americans don't do that when they come to Rwanda. They come over here because they've got all the solutions, because you know how to do it. You know, so there's a little bit of a danger in the this groundswell of support about AIDS and Africa with Bono and everything else. I'm very supportive of it, but I also think it has a certain faddish element to it. And for goodness sakes, if it takes Bono to do it, I mean, we are supposed to be driven by deeper concerns about justice than that. And that's what would make it long term. So, I mean, even if you look at Seattle philanthropy, what's happening is that people want to self-direct their philanthropy. They don't want to give their money to somebody else. They want to start their own philanthropy and do it their own way. And in that is a kind of a confession of pride, and we know how to do it. And so, I mean, I think in the book, in the Culturally Savvy Christian, on the section on the Christianity that we're in and understanding it, I start with this line: what if we think we're in a high point in church history and we're actually in a low point? You know, what if we're actually in the 400 years of captivity where Israel was in Egypt, and they were like terribly dark years, but we think they're great years because we're rich, and we got all these radio stations, all this stuff. But what if we're kind of in these spiritual dark ages? That sobers me. The developing world revivalism is really phenomenal to watch, but it's also, if you look at it carefully, there's a lot of factors going on there. Among them, for instance, in the South Korean church, there's a huge dose of the health wealth gospel in the growth of the South Korean church. And they will argue that the reason North Korea needs to come to Christ is so they can be wealthy like South Korea. You know, so you have to kind of look at what's actually happening. And I shouldn't be speaking about this because, for goodness sakes, there's people in this room that are missiologists and really have studied this very carefully. But I think we have to be really observant of what's going on in the great growth of the church in Africa and Asia and the decline of the church in America coupled with humanitarian interests. You know, if it's motivated properly and it comes out of deep concerns for justice, that's cool. If it's not, I'm not so sure it's going to last.
Got a question from Benjamin for you, Dick.
Is the hollow, empty nature of both popular culture and Christianity light related directly to an excess of wealth and power, kind of like anorexia is a disease that only occurs where there's more than enough food? How can we facilitate a redistribution of both Christian and secular culture so we can experience some of the reality and power of the spirituality of the extremely poor?
Could you repeat that question? I mean that sincerely. There were a few pieces to it.
I asked, is the hollow and empty nature of both popular culture and Christianity light related to an excess of wealth and power, kind of like anorexia is a disease that only occurs where there is more than enough food? If so, how can we facilitate a redistribution of both Christian and secular culture so we can experience some of the reality and power of the spirituality of the extremely poor?
That's a complicated question. I mean, I think at one level, Benjamin, right? In the book I wrote, Christian Wisdom of the Jedi Masters, you know, you look at the paradigm that George Lucas set up in the 70s. A lot of us remember when the first Star Wars came out, because he made this very simple mythology. It was about the dark side and this battle against the dark side. So rather than rooting it necessarily I really think we are at a very deep level in spiritual warfare. And I think in C.S. Lewis's terminology, Screwtape is alive and well. And Screwtape may use different methodologies with the Christians than he does with the culture. But in either case, the end result is the same, that we would bow our knee to the dark side, that we would not, in fact, yield to the one true living God. I mean, the story the story of the Garden of Eden is so basic in its kind of construct of Satan tempting Adam and Eve and saying, you know, you will not die, you know, you will become gods, you know, and you see this repeated problem throughout the biblical story that what we want to do is be God. And the writer Nevada Barr, who struggled as a novelist and was an alcoholic and finally came back to faith, and she said, "All of my life I wanted to be God, and then I realized I am not supposed to be God, but I am of God." That little phrase, "I am of God." In other words, we're created in God's image. And our essential problem is believing that it's that image means that we are God, not God-like. And it's as, to me, it's as basic as this Paul saying, "I urge you to present your bodies as a living sacrifice." You know, don't be conformed to the world, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. This basic cosmic struggle comes down, irreligious and religious alike, to whether we will acknowledge our dependence on God and name God as central and have our waking thought be, "What do I do to bring greater glory to you today?" I mean, I like Teilhard de Chardin's phrase, "We're not human beings having a spiritual experience, we're spiritual beings having a human experience." That ultimately, the most significant reality is the spiritual reality. We're entrapped in this flesh for a brief period of time. So, I mean, I think there's a more universal theme underlying the impoverishment of intellect and art and creativity, and it's the glorification of humans over the glorification of God.
Mm.
Wow.
There we go.
Yeah, I'm tired.
Yeah. Yeah, we put you to work tonight. That's
I know. I'm usually just coasting and making everybody else work.
That's right. We usually wrap up with a final soundbite from guest and host. So do we do rock, paper, scissors to see who goes
no,
first?
No, you go ahead first and then I'll...
Okay. Well, I think your book, The Culturally Savvy Christian, and tonight's conversation reminds me of a character who lived in Scotland, where else, and who was depicted in the movie Chariots of Fire. And the character Eric Liddell has a conversation with his sanctimonious Pharisaical sister Jenny in Edinburgh, who's kind of concerned that Eric's doing these diversionary pursuits. He's playing rugby for Scotland, he's out track and field, and what about the mission? And his rationale for his life goes like this. He says, "Jenny, God made me fast, and when I run, I feel his pleasure." Now, if that had been the story of Bill Hogg, I would have said, "Jenny, God made me slow, and and when I run, I hear his laughter." You know? But I think in many respects, the man who died in China as a prisoner of war, Eric Liddell, represents perhaps the essence of the culturally savvy Christian, because he calls us to a place in a life where we live for God's glory, we live for God's pleasure, and that brings us pleasure. And also the challenge for me as an exiled Scotsman asking the question in Babylon the Great, the United States of America, how can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land, is he was a man who refused to allow his faith and his pursuit of God to become compartmentalized. Mm-hmm. You know, was he Eric Liddell the rugby player? Was he Eric Liddell the gold medalist in the 1924 Paris Olympics? Was he Eric Liddell the preacher and the missionary? He was Eric Liddell all of the above. And I think part of the challenge is for us to take our meager gifts and talents and to use them for God's glory and to make the passionate pursuit of God primary, and to constantly battle against what I think's maybe part of the dark side, to live a compartmentalized faith.
Mm-hmm. That's well put, Bill. And thank you, by the way, for tonight. I want to end with some words from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and he spoke, that sounded like Connor, you know,
Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I'll give you some diction classes later.
Alexander Solzhenitsyn.
At
Harvard University in 1978, in a really famous kind of clarion call to the Western world. And here's some of what he said. "After the suffering of decades of violence and oppression, The human soul longs for things higher, warmer, and purer than those offered by today's mass living habits, introduced by the revolting invasion of publicity, by TV stupor, and by intolerable music. If the world has not approached its end, it has reached a major watershed in history equal in importance to the turn from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance. It will demand from us a spiritual blaze. We shall have to rise to a new height of vision, to a new level of life. This is Dick Staub. Thanks for joining us on the Kindling's Muse. Thank you for listening to the Kindling's Muse. If this program sparks something in you, I invite you to participate at www.thekindlings.com. That's K-I-N-D-L-I-N-G-S. Share this program, tell a friend, or just leave a comment at www.thekindlings.com.